Welcome once again to our program, Salvation History, the Old Testament, the story of creation, fall, and the beginning of the redemption, our freeing of humankind. Our guest for this wonderful series is again Ron Eldred, who teaches religion and history at John Paul II Catholic High. I'm your host, Monsignor Larry Moran, chaplain down at the convent of Carmelite Sisters just south of Terre Haute at the entrance to Allendale. Ron, we're beginning our 22nd series in this salvation history, and we got up to talking about the law, particularly the law of Moses, and it's so critical or bullseye theme in the Bible. Let's talk some more specifically about the law in the Bible.
I think that this is one of the most important topics to talk about, because in the New Testament, in the letters that St. Paul writes, he talks a lot about the law. He tells the Jews and he tells the Gentiles that they're not under the law. But he doesn't mean the Ten Commandments. That's what we have to make very clear, and that's what we're going to try to do in the next couple of sessions anyway. He's talking about laws that deal with ritual purity, laws that deal with how liturgical kinds of things. He's talking about dietary kinds of laws, things of that sort.
Okay, and so really a critical distinction. He's not talking about we're free from the Ten Commandments.
That's right, because there have been people who have interpreted St. Paul that way at various times in history. But that's true. The law is one of the most fundamental concepts in the Bible. And in the Old Testament, it means the law of Moses, as found in the first five books, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. And this is known as the Torah in Hebrew and the Pentateuch in Greek. And essentially, the law is the requirement for the Israelites to fulfill their covenant with God. And in return for obeying the law, they were rewarded with many descendants, with land, peace, and prosperity. Though on the other hand, when they broke the law, in accordance with the Deuteronomic theme that we've also discussed, they were punished by war, famine, disease, natural disasters, and the like. And the Ten Commandments, they are the heart of the law. But in addition, as we said earlier in the series, in order to maintain their chosen status, to set them apart from all other peoples, the Israelites were required to abide by hundreds of laws regarding ritual purity, dietary matters, liturgical rites, sabbatical practices, and the like. And these laws were intended to help the Israelites be a holy nation and to be set apart from all of the other peoples.
Okay, but how about the law now in the New Testament?
As we discussed in earlier sessions, the New Testament is a fulfillment of the Old. As we will discuss when we get to the New Testament in this series, Jesus maintained the law of the Old Testament, but he fulfilled it, in other words. But he refined and perfected it in many ways, and we'll talk about how he did that when the time comes. His emphasis is on the law of love, the love of God and neighbor. The first three of the Ten Commandments relate to our love of God and obligation to God, whereas the second seven relate to the love of and obligation to our neighbors. And as we will discover when we study St. Paul much later in the series, Christians are not required to abide by most of the hundreds of laws regarding ritual purity, diet, liturgical rites, sabbatical practices, etc.
The most prominent being circumcision. That was kind of the baptism for the Jewish people that made them member of the people of God, as baptism makes us member of the family of God.
And of course, these things were definitively decided at the Council of Jerusalem.
Okay, around, when was the Council of Jerusalem?
49
A.D. Okay. Ron, I think it'd be helpful if we discussed the law of Moses in the context of God's law.
Yes, I think that's right. First, we'll define law itself. It has been defined as, quote, a binding custom or practice of a community, a rule of conduct or action prescribed or formally recognized as binding or enforced by a controlling authority, end of quote. God is the ultimate controlling authority of all law. St. Thomas Aquinas distinguished between four kinds of law: eternal, natural, human, and divine. One scholar has said of these categories that, quote, eternal law is the decree of God that governs all creation. Natural law is the human participation in the eternal law. That was St. Thomas's definition, if I recall right, and is discovered by reason. Natural law, of course, is based on first principles. Human law is positive law, and we'll explain that later. The natural law applied by governments to societies. Divine law is specifically revealed law in the scriptures. That ends that quote.
Okay, now all law begins with God's eternal law. So could we start with that?
The Catholic concept of law begins with the divine or the eternal law of God. The eternal law has been defined as, quote, the plan of divine wisdom insofar as it directs all the actions and events of the universe, end of quote. Germain Grisez, one of the world's leading moral theologians who teaches at Georgetown University, I think he also teaches at a seminary in Baltimore, or has, he states that, quote, since eternal law embraces the whole of creation, any other reasonable plan of action must somehow derive from it. People can plan their lives reasonably only because, in one way or another, they share in the universal plan perfectly presented in God's eternal law. If they try to follow a plan not somehow derived from eternal law, their lives will be unrealistic, as would be the behavior of workers on a large project who departed from the project's master plan in order to follow some other plan, end of quote.
Okay, well, that's the basis of all law. This brings us to the natural law. Can we take a look at that?
The natural law flows from the eternal law. Father John Harden, whom we've quoted many times in this series and in other series that we have had, he was one of the world's greatest theologians and catechists until his death in 2000. He says that the natural law is, quote, what God has produced in the world of creation as coming to human beings. It is what they know or can know of what God has created. It is therefore called natural law because everyone is subject to it from birth, because it contains only those duties which are derivable from human nature itself, and because, absolutely speaking, its essentials can be grasped by the unaided light of human reason, end of quote. And to make his point, Father Harden paraphrases St. Paul as saying, quote, pagans who never heard of the law but are led by reason to do what the law commands may not actually possess the law, but they can be said to be the law. They can point to the substance of the law engraved on their hearts. They can call a witness, that is, their own conscience. They have accusation and defense, that is, their own inner mental dialogue. If you want to, people want to go to the actual quote itself, it's in Romans 2, verses 14 through 15. He was paraphrasing Romans there, Romans.
All right, so even the pagans can know the natural law by a clear use of their reason. So let's talk about some of those places the Bible refers to the natural law and give us a few examples.
Well, St. Paul writes in Romans 2:14-15 that, quote, when Gentiles who have not the law do by nature what the law requires, they are a law to themselves, even though they do not have the law. They show that what the law requires is written on their hearts, while their conscience also bears witness, and their conflicting thoughts accuse, or perhaps excuse them, on that day, when according to my gospel, God judges the secrets of men by Jesus Christ. End of quote. He is here, of course, referring to the natural law. Furthermore, in the book of Deuteronomy, Moses tells the Israelites that God's law is already in their hearts. We find this in Deuteronomy 30:14. The prophet Jeremiah said regarding the natural law, quote, "But this is the covenant which I will make with the house of Israel after those days, says the Lord. I will put my law within them, and I will write it upon their hearts. And I will be their God, and they shall be my people." This is found in Jeremiah 31:33. Moreover, extra biblical sources, that is, you know, other than in the Bible, include St. Thomas Aquinas, who refers several places to the law of God written on the human heart. And Pope John Paul II quotes St. Paul's Romans text in his encyclical Veritatis Splendor in connection with the discussion of the natural law.
Okay, now, for instance, it would be self-evident even to a pagan that to lie, that there's something disordered about that. To steal, someone worked and brought their crops in the night, take them. There's something in the human heart that says this is not right. We don't have to just right reason without any knowledge of God's laws of the Ten Commandments, shall not steal, shall not bear false witness. It's just written in human nature, although the communists ended up saying, well, we can lie if it's for a good reason. And of course, that was a real aberration.
I think the law is confirmed by the fact that the consequences of breaking the Ten Commandments, which is nothing more than the natural law written or written down, that when people commit adultery, when they fornicate, when they lie, they cheat, they steal, when they bear false witness, when they covet other people's goods, it leads to all kinds of problems. It causes all kinds of unhappiness. It causes all kinds of suffering and sorrow and sometimes even death. So it's just natural. It's a part of nature. It's just a part of the way things are.
But even Paul said that people can, even though they should know by nature what is right, many times they have silenced this voice within them of right reason and gone ahead and committed terrible crimes or terrible sins or terrible offenses that cause chaos for individuals and people in the family or even for a nation.
So St. Paul also says they'll have no excuse.
Because
it is written on their hearts.
Written in their hearts.
It's a part of their nature.
So it's what we traditionally have called conscience. And one of the problems of our culture and our society, there's a great tendency to muffle or to silence the small whisper of the voice of conscience that stealing is wrong or lying is wrong. Well, I can lie for a good reason. And if we get enough, we can rationalize enough to suffocate the voice of conscience. Okay, well, St. Thomas had a lot to say about the natural law as written on the heart of every person. Could we briefly say something about that, Ron?
Yes, St. Thomas Aquinas, he says in his Summa Theologica that the natural law is, quote, nothing else than the rational creature's participation in the eternal law. He has said elsewhere in the Summa that people are naturally disposed to understand some basic practical principles, which he calls the primary principles of natural law. And since everyone knows them naturally, no one can make a mistake about them. A document of Vatican Council II states that, quote, "The Church calls these naturally known principles natural law. They are natural to the sense, in the sense that they are not humanly enacted, but are objective principles which originate in human nature," end of quote.
Okay. So it's really right reason making a judgment if something is ordered or disordered. And right reason tells us, well, to lie and pretend to be telling the truth, it's disordered. It's a malfunctioning of what I was given the power of speech for. If I, for instance, it's so terrible to swear under oath, because if I can't, if society can't find out the truth ultimately by an oath before God, there's no way to find out the truth. A person's, so even a perjury is a serious criminal offense. Well, although the natural law is written on our hearts, we often don't interpret it correctly. And why is this so?
Well, as St. Paul tells us, the natural law is the law of God written on our hearts. And this means that human beings have the ability to use their reason to know and to understand the natural law of things as God has created them. However, due to our fallen nature, we do not always interpret this natural law correctly. And when we fail to do so, it causes, as we said a while ago, unhappiness, as well as personal and social problems. And due to the fact that fallen human beings do not always properly interpret the natural law, God made explicit his law when he revealed them in the Ten Commandments to Moses at Mount Sinai.
Okay, so actually we can say that the Ten Commandments could be just reasonably arrived to by a clear-thinking person. Maybe they wouldn't have arrived to the seventh day, keep holy the seventh day of the Sabbath day, but they would arrive that I owe some kind of allegiance and connection with my Creator.
Well, you know, some of the great philosophers, especially the Greek philosophers before Christianity, came to a lot of the similar conclusions to what the Hebrews were finding out by revelation at the same time. And then, of course, Christ, when he comes to fulfill the law, reveals in more detail. He perfects this law. But they'd already gone a long way toward understanding these things. Even the Romans, who adopted a lot of the Greek ways, had discovered a lot of these things.
And, of course, that's what we're losing in our culture when, as Pope Benedict said, the dictatorship of our time that makes us robots is relativism, that the first starting thought is there is no ability to attain truth. What is good? What is bad? What is truth? What is falsehood? And that underlies our relationships today, that if it's bad for you, it may be good for me. I can lie, but okay, if you think it's wrong, you shouldn't lie. I can commit adultery if nobody gets hurt, supposedly, when somebody always gets hurt. But that making each person determine what is right and wrong is so much the cause of utter confusion in our thinking today.
Yes.
Okay, well, you just mentioned the effects of original sin on the use of reason. That original sin seems to keep showing its head constantly in about every problem that we have. So what's a little bit more about this original sin and the use of reason?
Well, even though this natural law is written on our hearts and then, of course, codified in the Ten Commandments, which means that human beings have the ability, this natural law, the ability to use their reason to know and understand the natural law of things as God has created them. We don't always interpret this natural law correctly because of our fallen nature, as we discussed in our last question there. But when we fail to do so, it causes others a lot of unhappiness as well as personal and social problems. And as a consequence of the fall, our intellects have been darkened or diminished. Our wills have been weakened. And concupiscence, that is, you know, an inclination to sin, a disordered passions, that type of thing, has brought disorder to our passions. As Professor Charles Rice, formerly professor of law at Notre Dame, and I think he also taught for a while at the Ave Maria School of Law, he tells us, because of our wounded nature, we are inclined to draw, quote, the wrong conclusions in their understanding or application of the secondary principles of the natural law. End of quote. For example, people can convince themselves that all sorts of acts are moral, such as lying, stealing, abortion, premarital sex, adultery, gay-lesbian relationships, contraception, assisted suicide, infanticide, euthanasia, and many, many others, that they're perfectly normal acts, at least in certain circumstances, whereas they are, in fact, serious violations of the natural law, and, of course, obviously, God's eternal law, which is based on God's eternal law.
Ron, read that again, because I think it applies so clearly to our society, that how we can rationalize and have rationalized how some horrible things like killing an innocent child is okay because I have the right to my own body, or I have the right to choose what I'm going to do, etc. Just read that section again, because I think it speaks eloquently to our present day.
You're using the word rationalization there. And that in the social science field means that giving sociably unacceptable answers for something, we would call them excuses.
Okay.
But the difference is, when people give rationalizations, is they believe them.
Okay.
They may be wrong, which they usually are, almost by definition, but I wanted to get that comment in there. But nonetheless, in fact, I've got an old saying that you heard the saying that the road to hell is paved with good intentions, but I also have one, the road to hell is paved with rationalizations.
Okay.
Yes, people convince themselves that all sorts of acts are moral, which in fact they aren't, such as lying and stealing, abortion, premarital sex, adultery, gay-lesbian relationships, contraception, assisted suicide, infanticide, euthanasia, and many others. They consider them perfectly normal acts, at least in certain circumstances or situations or contexts or whatever you might have. But they're really all serious violations of the natural law and, of course, of God's eternal law. And they're wrong because they cause all kinds of problems. I mean, God doesn't forbid us to do things just because for no reason at all. He has reasons for doing it, for our own good.
And that's a necessary insight, I think, because sometimes we say, well, God says something's wrong just because he wants us to see if we're going to obey. But God says something's wrong because it's destructive to a person or to a persons or society. Commandments are to protect us. They're not to limit our freedom. They're to keep us free to do right and know where the fence is, that we don't go over the fence and fall down the cliff.
Yeah, whether or not we recognize it or not, these acts hurt other people and cause human suffering and sorrow and even death. And when humans violate this natural order of things, we must pay the consequences. One can't lie, cheat, steal, kill, fornicate, and adulterate without creating problems for himself or herself and others, any more than he can jump off a tall building and violate the law of gravity. Such violations of the natural order have caused untold damage and misery in our world over the centuries. And God gave us the commandments to help us control our appetites and passions for our good and the good of others. God's not a killjoy. He's not a spoil sport who does not want us to have any fun. For after all, he gave us these appetites, these drives, these passions for a reason. Although bodily pleasures associated with sensual appetites can threaten our eternal salvation, they are not evil in themselves. God gave us appetites which are pleasurable to satisfy in order to conserve the individual and the human race. For example, the appetite to consume beverages and food is essential to our survival as individuals. And the appetite to procreate is essential for our survival of the human species. And if these activities were not pleasurable, no one would willingly eat or drink or procreate. However, because of original sin, the appetite for pleasure often wars against the demands of reason and causes us to sin. And when we sin, we abuse them rather than use them for God's glory and the benefit of ourselves and others. To give an example, to abuse the appetite for food and drink, which is gluttony, or the appetite to procreate, which is lust, harms us and others, no matter what certain philosophers will tell us. Germain Grisez, whom we quoted a while ago, earlier in the session, a prominent moral theologian, says of this matter, quote, "Although we are naturally disposed to know basic practical principles and can make no mistake about them, they are not by themselves sufficient for the judgment of conscience which we must make. Our ultimate end is to share in fulfillment in the Lord Jesus, and we do not judge rightly what to do unless we judge in light of this end. So we must supplement natural law with faith. By this means, drawing on the eternal law in a way that goes beyond reason." End of quote.
Okay, so even though by natural law or by right reason, we can attain to a knowledge, as many, you mentioned, philosophers did, Aristotle and Plato, because of the darkness caused by our woundedness from original sin, it's really without revelation very, very difficult to follow what right reason tells us to do. I think Cardinal Newman has a beautiful statement, who was beatified recently by the Holy Father. Newman said, "As well expect to control human passion alone by reason alone as to moor a ship with a thread of silk or quarry granite with a razor blade." That human passion, anger, resentment, lust, greed are so powerful that just to say, well, this isn't reasonable, it's not going to be able to harness that without God's grace. And I think that's what we experience all through history.
Newman certainly had a lot to say about conscience. In fact, Newman believed that conscience, by the fact that we have a conscience, is one of the proofs for God's existence, that there would be no other real explanation for human beings having such a faculty.
Yes, he had gave some new emphasis to thinking, not just with Thomas Aquinas,
yes,
reasoning to God's existence, but from intuition and conscience and
experience. And that's which, of course, wasn't very popular at the time.
Sure.
And later on, it becomes more and more acceptable. In fact, Leo XIII made him a cardinal in the church for his contributions to theology, but especially, of course, for his theology on conscience and his theology on the development of Christian doctrine.
Okay. Well, Rod, again, our sands have run through the hourglass of time. So to our radio listening audience, we say may God bless you all, always and in all ways.